Welcome to this episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Special Agent Darren Mott. In this episode, I'll discuss an online undercover case from the cyber intellectual property rights era of the early 2000s with a very special guest. But before we get to that case, I'd like to start with a couple news or cybersecurity items of note and make a point that next week I'm going to talk specifically on protection of our more senior population when it comes to cyber threats. So be on the lookout for that. But a couple things I want to talk about in this very beginning part is a couple things that have come to note to me over the last couple of days. I just want to make a point of mentioning so you're aware of them and you can inform your more senior relatives of these particular scams so they don't become victims. The first one is a very common kidnap scam that we see a lot online. I mentioned this because my wife had mentioned to me that a friend of hers had a relative that was victimized of this recently. Essentially, what happens is the bad guys get information, likely from the dark web or from going through and scouring open social media accounts, looking for kids who tag their grandparents and have information on their names and where they live and things like that. It's not that hard to find information on individuals once you have a name and general location. The phone numbers, email addresses are fairly easy to track down without having to spend any money at all. If you spend a little bit of money, you can get a whole lot of information. But the way this particular scheme works, and you may be aware of it, is a grandparent will get an email or a phone call from what appears to be their grandchild saying, help, I've been kidnapped, or I'm overseas on a trip and I had my wallet stolen. Well, that's not a kidnapping part of it, but it's the same general scam, but some kind of scam where there's some kind of money involved. Kidnapping is one of the more common ones simply because if a grandparent hears that their grandchild has been kidnapped, they're going to do all they can to get that grandchild back. So the scammers will ask for $10,000, $5,000, whatever they think they can get from the person. They'll then ask them to give them that money generally, and sometimes in gift cards. They may actually have them go all the way to a bank, but generally seems to be gift cards is the main focus of that. So what should happen in this, which would be good due diligence, is if you're a grandparent and you get called that appears to be your grandchild, is to call the parents of that child and make sure they're not been kidnapped or they're not stranded overseas. I know that my mother got a call apparently from my son claiming he was stranded somewhere and needed $1,000. Fortunately, she called me. I said, no, he's sitting right here next to me, and we resolved it. But there's plenty of people that are going to fall for that scam. So just, again, be aware of it. Educate folks on how to not become victims of that. The second point I want to make in this section is some new email phishing attacks we're going to see coming up. We are 10 weeks from the presidential election, and so there's going to be a lot of emails going out that have to deal with focusing on particular candidates, likely presidential candidates, Joe Biden or Donald Trump, and asking you to click on a link to support that candidate or click on a link to support the candidate's opponent, something along those lines. There may be an attachment that shows, hey, here's information on your polling place, things of that nature. You are unlikely to get those kind of emails from your state polling agency with things to click on. So just be aware that you're going to see a lot more of those coming forward. Again, I reiterate making a point of letting your more senior relatives know of these things because they may not understand it. They may click on the link. They may open the attachment, and they can become victimized in any of a number of different ways. So I'll talk more about these things next week in next week's episode that is focused primarily on protecting seniors. But let me get to the main point of this podcast, which is one of my first big case, actually my one big case in the FBI when I was in the Charlotte field office in the early 2000s. It ended up being a 5-year cyber undercover that I ran from 2001 to 2006. And it was focused on targeting online piracy groups called WARES groups. And it was codenamed Operation Sudden Urge. Granted, this is not the coolest code name ever. But let me briefly explain how the FBI comes up with code names. So this is going to be your FBI lesson of the week. It's how do we do things in the FBI, and this is how to come up with code names. Because if you watch big cases that have gone down in the past, they all had names that had some meaning for that particular whatever the case was. If it was a drug case, it had a, some kind of drug name or things like that. If I had done any preparation for this part of the podcast, I would have had some examples. I don't have those at handy, so I apologize for that. But so mine was called Sudden Urge. And the way that you come up with an FBI code name, there's two ways. There's the official way, and then there's the better way. So the official way is there is a unit at FBI headquarters that maintains a database that when you call and say, I need a code name for a case or for an undercover, a lot of times in the national security realm, they code name subjects of those cases with code names for national security reasons. They'll send you five options. Generally, it's an adjective followed by a noun. In this case, mine was not necessarily, but so you'll get like purple rainbow or fancy unicorn, odd names like that really mean nothing other than they're two names that this particular program spit out and give you an option for. You pick one. And you go back and say, I'm going to take this one. They take that name out of the database and you're off and running. So that was the mistake I made. I had a training agent that was, he was a good guy. Wasn't the greatest training agent in the world. But no one advised me. Even my headquarter overlords didn't advise me that you can come up with any name you want. It doesn't have to be what this particular database spits out. That's the better way. Come up with it yourself. You then basically send the name to that unit and they tell you whether or not you can, it's been used or if you can keep it or not. If it's not a name that has been used, you're more than welcome to go ahead and use it. I was not aware I could do this. And so I took the one name out of the five given me that sounded the least stupid. In this case, it was Sudden Urge. The name has nothing to do with the basis of the case. But I got used to saying it over time. And so that was the name of the undercover. So, that's how we come up with code names. So next time you hear one, if it sounds like something they're investigating, like if it's a drug case and there's some kind of drug or cartel name in the name, you can probably figure that they made it up themselves. If it makes no sense, it means they did it the official way. For example, I'm pretty sure Crossfire Hurricane was likely done the official route simply because if they had come up with Orange Man Bad or something around those lines, that would have not looked good when the case came out, much like it has come out now, and it doesn't look good, but not because of the name, because the name has, and if you were to hear that particular code name, you would have no idea who the target was. So that's kind of how that's how we do cases, how we code name cases in the FBI. So the case I'm going to talk about it was a five-year undercover, like I mentioned. It targeted online piracy. So these were groups. These were not groups that simply traded in music and movies. We focused on particular groups and individuals within those groups that cracked software, expensive software at the time. From 2001 to 2006, software was pretty expensive. Adobe Photoshop, for example, ran $800 to $1,000. We had one piece of software that we captured that was about $600,000 for a license. So it was a lot of loss to legitimate business. And at the time, intellectual property right became a priority for the FBI to investigate. And I happened to meet up with a guy who became a source of mine who was involved with this world and made it very easy for us to get involved with these folks. And that's really where most FBI cases are successful, when you have good sources that can help you with that. So as him and I talk about this, we're going to look at the 15,000 foot view of this case for the most part. We're hoping when we were done talking, I've recorded this previously, but when we were done talking, we started talking about other things we could have mentioned that were just little things that happened within the case. So we're just kind of amusing little anecdotes of things we had to do. And so we'll probably touch on this again down the line where we'll get into some of the little minutia things that we did, because, you know, when you watch an FBI TV show, you see them, you know, going out and doing raids and doing all sorts of stuff. This case was a typical FBI case. There was a lot of paperwork generated. There was a lot of court subpoenas sent out to try to identify people. And at the end, we ended up arresting folks. We did search warrants in a whole bunch of different cities and countries around the world. And I'll talk about that a little bit when I'm done talking with my guest. So let's get to my guest for the purpose of this podcast. I'm going to call him John, but that's not his real name, as he was my confidential human source during this undercover operation and really helped the FBI get into the depths of several online piracy groups and ultimately dismantle them to the best that we could. The whole wares community is kind of like the drug drug trade, you can take off bits of it, but it's going to pretty much continue on as it continues on today, as I'm sure he'll mention during the course of this conversation. So he's calling in from the phone. I may modify his voice when I'm done, when I'm editing this podcast, to kind of protect his identity, but he's no longer a source for the FBI, so he's kind of a freelancer. He's a security professional for a big company down in Charlotte. And so, John, I want to thank you for taking the time to come talk to me today.
Thank you.
So let's start off with, how'd you get involved in the WERS scene, and maybe explain where that particular phrase came from?
So WERS is a play on the word software, and just part and parcel of that word. And that's essentially what was being targeted for a race to see who could release a cracked copy of it first. My involvement started with a trace from a news group to an IRC group that and pretty much introduced me to IRC from the news group area, and from there basically started noticing a lot of different conversation. I wasn't really involved with any groups per se. I was told that, hey, if you need to get this particular I think it was a book I was looking for at the time or something like this. And it wasn't really software per se. And they said, you go here to actually get it. And so they gave me access to a location where I was only supposed to be able to see some information, but I ended up seeing a lot more than I was supposed to. Now, I didn't say anything about it, but I basically took a step back and said, okay, there's a lot of stuff here. Where does all this actually come from? So, I started asking questions and got shot down and told that, you won't have access to that. That comes from a special group. So it was a very rough start, in the beginning, as far as getting introduced to that world. I would say it took some time, before I actually really understood what I was asking to be involved.
And how was the operational security for these groups at this time? Keep in mind, we're talking, 2000, or actually for you, probably 99, somewhere in there.
So it was like 97, late 97, 98, 99. So even then, it was, you were introduced as who knows you, right? And so you couldn't just walk in the door and go, hey, I'd like to join your group kind of thing. It did not, even back then, it didn't work like that. I will say the encryption that was used later on, that we'll speak about later, wasn't even in existence. IRC had no encrypted connection type back then, and everything was dial-up or ISDN connected. So you were really limited in how often you could connect, which was pretty much the fail-safe for a lot of these folks, because they knew that eventually people would disconnect and there would be only certain people online that they could then have certain types of conversations. So, it was very easy to get in. I would have to say, with the exception of having to be invited.
Sure. And so you mentioned IRC, Internet Relay Chat, which was the main communication portal at the time. It's still in existence today, but I don't think it's quite as widely used as most other. I would be tempted to say that most millennials have no idea what IRC is. Is that correct?
That is correct. But one thing I will point out, and we'll reiterate this later on, is that if you're on IRC, it's not to have a normal conversation right. Anymore. Back then, you would actually get on there. You would actually get on there to try to get a hold of somebody sometimes. I mean, the Yahoo chat wasn't available yet. Even ICQ wasn't available. But today people have so many different ways of communicating, that IRC or even web IRC that's available today. You really are not going out there unless you have a purpose.
Right. And they had their own protocols and their own connection. You couldn't just go to www.irc and log in.
No, not back then. No, not at all. And it even got more complicated than that as things progressed. So we found that I would say that in the coming years, it went from having a straight connection to having password protected channels to having actual embedded scripts doing off-the-record type encryption. So as you would type in your communication, it would actually encrypt it. And if the person on the other side didn't have the key, they couldn't read it. So if anybody from the outside actually did get access to the channel, it would just look like a bunch of machine guns.
So how'd you come to work for the FBI? Because in most cases with confidential human sources, it's not, I will say though, in the cyber world, a lot of them come to us because they want to help. But in your case, you didn't exactly walk into the FBI office in Charlotte and said, "Hey, I have a lot of information. How can I help?" How did you come to our attention? Because I think it's an interesting story.
It is. I was actually invited to the party,
yes.
but not exactly by way of mail or phone call. More of a knock on the door, and everybody hears the story. The last person you want knocking on your door is the FBI. But in my case, it was interesting because it was more of a visit to inquire about somebody that had already been visited by them earlier as the target of the FBI. I wasn't so much a target as I was, a reference. So the person that they came to talk to me about was actually a friend of mine that went to a local college, and he was, I knew that he was involved with the trade at a level that I didn't quite understand. I had a house, that he had an apartment, so I had a lot more room and so forth. So he would store things at my home, and I didn't really think much of it other than the fact that, he gave me access to where he actually was getting that stuff from. And so, I will say that I understood then more about what he was giving me, because before I moved in that house, he introduced me to a group that, was called WCTF 4K, and 4K was for, 4 gigabytes. They had 4 gigabytes of storage on a server where they were keeping, video games, mostly video games. They would fit on a floppy disk, right? So when you go to a convention, you would have, they would sell the floppy disk there with, Lemmings or whatever your game was. These guys would take it and be able to package it in a way that stuck it out there on the internet for folks to be able to go ahead and download rather than go buy it for $2 or whatever it was. So I got introduced to that, and it was, again, a very low level, experience with wares even then, because I didn't know who the movers and shakers were. I didn't have any idea how big the organizations were. And so, but I was curious. And the one thing that really challenged me with this, and this is what I told the agents that visited me, was the being told I couldn't join, being told I couldn't be part of something, or being told that you need to be able to have this level of experience or access or something. And I'm like, you know what? It's got to be easier than that. There's got to be a way in here that I don't need, somebody else. So what I ended up finding out was that by contributing to it, there by being a contributor, not so much a source for the file per se, but some other way to contribute. How could I contribute, services or a skill set or something like this? So in my case, it was a skill set. And so that skill set led to the introduction of my friend that I met at the local college. And so then, we became, friends and hung out on occasion. But they came over to ask me about him. But what they were letting me know is that, look, your friend is more involved with something more nefarious than you think. You think it's just some innocent couple floppy disks of things. But all this stuff that he's got sitting over here, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars of worth of information that is not hidden. And so we would like your help in learning more about what you know about what he's doing, or even get you to, have him tell you more about what he actually has, going on. And so, I the way they explained it to me, I was not in favor of the action that he was involved in. And I think that kind of angered me because I thought that we were friends enough to where he would at least let me know that he was involved at that level. So that was another challenge for me. How do I get more information out of him? But also, how do I go after these? How do I help, you know, to identify some of these groups that he's involved in? And so I sat down and went through with the agents on what I knew, and based on my conversation with them, they said, "Hey, would you like to help us a little bit further?" And then they basically invited me to attend a briefing on the whole effort, all in and of itself.
Yeah, and then if I recall, I was not your original source handler, I guess, for lack of a better term. It was this particular, the investigating the wares groups or intellectual property was actually a white collar issue at the time, even though all of this was cyber focused. And I've said this for a long time. Cyber is really not its own thing. It's tradecraft. So white collar crime has cyber components, terrorism does, and so on and so forth. So you were originally assigned to the white collar squad, but then as this became more technically based, there's a lot more cyber pieces to it. The agent, do you remember the agent's name? That was that handled you for, yeah, David Yu. Remember David Yu?
Yes.
Yeah, so David Yu was your first handler. So
yes.
He had come up to me and said, "Hey, I got this source. He's got interesting access to these groups, but it's really not anything we work. Seems like more in your what you'd want to do." And at the time, the FBI had started looking at intellectual property rights as a significant problem and raised the priority of it within the cyber world. Now, at this point, we're talking 2000, 2001, there was no cyber division. The FBI was still trying to figure out what to do with this whole cyber beast.
So
it came to me, and I think you and I sat down and talked, and we came up with this plan of how we could be, well, I'll let you explain it. So how would you explain our master plan for this undercover?
So I think the main thing that was first was how do we take folks at school to better educate, you know, the supporting elements of the squad to better understand what exactly we're going to be trying to do, right? Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, we had people from organized crime there. We had people from narcotics there, because I remember vividly one of the questions that was constantly asked me in these meetings was, well, where's the money, right? What's the motivation? Why is there no monetary, you know, motivation here? And, you know, and then of course the organized crime folks were like, well, what's the structure? You know, there's got to be a leader. There's got to be, you know, some sort of counselor or something like this. And so I think that by having that interaction with them, it helped me look at what do we actually go and look for? Right. So, but the other thing that they couldn't wrap their heads around is back then, this is long before ransomware, right? And things like today, they're, you know, very monetarily driven, in terms of cybercrime. It was a race to see who could get it first. It was all about nostalgia and popularity, right? In that world. So it had nothing to do with money. People were not selling this stuff. And if there were people selling it, then that was, you know, it was a very small percentage. So knowing that this was merely just the transmission, and trading of this type of information, led folks to think that you know, is this really worth the effort, right? So our plan was to be able to expose what that structure actually consists of and convince the folks that there is enough there to show that there is a tremendous enterprise, monetary or not, that is trafficking intellectual property on a mass scale.
And I think the thing that got us over the edge was there was a report that came out by either the Business Software Alliance or someone else that said the amount of loss to business was $6 billion per year. And $6 billion in 2000, 2001, that people start looking at that and say that is probably a serious problem. And now other people argue, well, really, what's the harm? Because they're just trading in movies or music. But we didn't focus on movies, and we got that stuff. We focused on the software pieces. Because those guys were a little more talented, because they had to get past the license restrictions.
Correct. Right. So they had to reverse engineer licensing restrictions. And so, and you had big names out there. You had AutoCAD, you had Microsoft, you had Adobe, you had all of these big names that, you know, Photoshop alone, I mean, back then was $8,000 to $1,200, you know, it was a very expensive, you know, software package. And AutoCAD is no cheap you know, piece either. And I think another one that we found that was a very big dollar amount, actually there were two, I remember. One was a medical-based application that I think alone was like six figures.
Yep, I think, you know, it was
the research company.
Right, I always remember that one was like $600,000 for one license.
Right, yeah, that one was ridiculously expensive. They cracked that one. And then there was another one that did all the parts for every car that's out there, right? Mm-hmm. So you could actually go and look up your vehicle and look up the different parts and things like that. I think that one was in the you know, thousands, the tens of thousands as well. So, you know, there were some pretty significant, you know, when you compare that to a movie, right? Yeah, a couple of us make a movie. But, and even music, I mean, there's, you know, you just, how do you put a hard value on that? Whereas you can put a hard value on the software in and of itself. So, I think that wasn't very well understood. And so part of our plan also was to be able to show that, you know, yes, the BSA was out there doing their efforts, but they were only as good as the information they had. But we were about to delve into an area that they would never be able to actually access and give even more information from that.
Right. I remember, so the summer of 2001 is when we started writing up what this undercover would look like. And you mentioned the organized crime groups couldn't wrap their heads around it because there was no money. But that's kind of how we focused it, is we targeted the groups and the individuals within the groups, especially the big groups that did the software cracking. And but I remember we spent all summer trying to come up with how this would – and you didn't have to do the writing, but you came up with the ideas of creating a large storage network. And so you would be the conduit to the groups,
right,
and then
correct.
We would store it on – So let's talk about the main gist of this undercover was creating this large network. So I'll let you kind of talk about the network, and then I'll talk about a couple little hiccups that happened between us actually – getting online or getting started with actually starting to build this network. But you go ahead. So explain how this network was going to work and why you felt it would be effective in getting these people on board to get the evidence we needed to ultimately arrest them.
Right. So this was actually a pretty, pretty clever way of convincing folks that you were worth the value that you were coming in on, because we weren't going to crack software. We weren't going to or crack copyrights. We weren't going to, supply, you know, actual software to be cracked. But one of the things that we found was detrimental was disk space. The second was bandwidth. Most of the sites that ran out there ran at the university. I think one of the servers that I actually contributed to was doubling as a coffee table at Virginia Tech. So they put black tape over the light so it wouldn't flash, and they put a black tablecloth over it and then put the creamer and sugars and everything on top of it, and it sat there and ran. And so the problem that it had was it was constantly running out of space. So the idea was, how do we take an operational server and we create a way for it to do a backup? And so what we found was, all of these groups that were out there all had their dedicated servers, and then they had servers that they used to interconnect with each other to actually do the trading between the servers. And so those are called release servers. So you had the main store server, then you had the release servers, and then you had your distribution servers, and then, of course, you had your bouncers that were used to transfer the stuff around. So we didn't want to provide, you know, anything. We wanted that to stay the way it was. So how do we keep that where it is, but also get some way to get into part of that interaction with those servers possibly? And the way we came up with that was an archive. So we decided to create a archive system that on the surface looked like it had terabytes of data, just tons of data, space available. And so in reality, we figured out a way to actually build an environment that on the surface would appear to be dedicated to a specific group, but when in fact was nothing more than a multi-tenant for several groups. But we divided it up in a way that appeared to be secure, and it appeared to be dedicated to those folks. So by bringing that to the table, that was almost an immediate invitation acceptance into several large groups, whether it be DOD, whether it be FLT, some of the other ones that were really risk, all the ones that were out there. So all the little groups that we started analyzing early on, Class, Paradigm, all these guys are releasing Core, all these guys are releasing very small, you know, floppy disk type size stuff, and they were sticking it on OpenFTP servers all over the place. That was, you know, the surface exposure, but we wanted something to be more behind the scenes, part of the core infrastructure of the interchange, and so we were able to do that with the archive server. We took it a step further when Side B and C came out, because that acted as a proxy to the server. So we were able to create another, what appeared to be another layer of security to the actual FTP servers themselves, but when in fact was nothing more than a dedicated bouncer or DNS name to a specific group to the other servers. We extended that to other servers that were already out there being hosted to make it look like, hey, we can mask your server sitting at RIT or Virginia Tech or anywhere else and make it look like it's coming from, you know, some other place. And even if they change the IP address, we'll be able to mask that for you as well. And so we actually stood up, if I remember, we stood up about 30 DNS, customized DNS environments, including our own, to facilitate that. And all of which allowed us to interconnect, all of these servers with ours and pull all this log data. We had login information from all the people that were actually logging into them. We had the interchange of transmissions going from one site to another. So we were able to capture all of this by the apparatus that we were able to create fictionally, making it look like it was also coming out of camp.
Yeah, and I should mention, this didn't all happen overnight. We started this idea of what this would look like in the summer of 2001, and we got to go through. I had to go through a lot of legal ramifications, like John mentioned that, you know, we couldn't be a release server, which was in that time, if Windows, yeah. So when Windows, let's use XP as an example, it came out later, but if Windows XP as an example got cracked, it would go on a release server, and then everybody who knew how to access it could go get it from the release server, and it would go out, and the group that cracked it would get the credit for it. Because we would have been the initial releaser, and so there was third-party liability, so we weren't allowed to do that. But archiving was fine because the stuff already existed. So that was the genius behind the plan was, when we were just archiving this, we were just, you know, we were a storage facility. We were self-storage for the wares community. So we're working through all this. We're almost done. And then 9/11/2001 hits. I'm in the middle of working on this undercover. I get a call from John saying, hey, are you watching TV? I said, no. Some plane just flew into the World Trade Center. So I went downstairs to watch it in the office, and then the second plane hit and all hell broke loose, and we didn't touch this again for a couple months. So finally December – I remember this ironically because it was 3 months later, December 11th, 2011, we got authority to start this undercover. And I should mention at the time – there was nobody else in the FBI doing what we were doing. This idea did not exist. What we were doing, how we were targeting it. People at headquarters had no idea what to make of me when I would say, "Here's what we're looking to do and how it'll work." I think we were able to confuse them enough that they're like, well, whatever they're doing sounds like it should work, so let's just give them money. And so we started off. The first server we had was a 1 terabyte server with three bouncers connected to them, sitting in a closet in FBI Charlotte's Cyber Squad area. And so this was a very hot room. Yeah. We ultimately were able to get AT&T. I was able to get headquarters to pay for a T1 network of AT&T set up, which was this humongous rack server that would spit out a whopping 1.5 megabits per second speed, which at the time unless you had a T3, you were flying with a T1, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And that cost a whopping $7,000 a month to pay for that T1 line. And that went on till about towards the end of 2002, early 2003. We'd started – because every time we would fill up a server, we'd basically just go build another one. And I don't know if you remember, you remember building these things from scratch?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember teaching you how to build them from scratch.
Exactly. Yes. Yes, you did.
I also remember, I would say that you were a quick study. I'll give you that. You were a quick study because it wasn't easy to maintain this. It was all Linux.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, there was no Windows in this whole thing. It was all Linux based. And then you had to learn, volume management. You had to learn, how to maintain, the disk, because I wasn't there right. to do that, and so I think that a lot of our time was, basically me teaching you how to maintain the environment, more or less, right? It's one thing to build it, right? But how do you maintain it? How do you keep it going? What do you do if it stops working, And the other thing we had to come up with, too, if you remember, we had to come up with reasons why it was going down.
Yes.
Because the way we sold this to the scene was that this was in a very secure place, a very, dependable data center, if you will, right, that they would never have to worry about it not being available, And, of course, we made a liar out of ourselves, I think, within the first month of that.
But they didn't care. So, they didn't care because it cost them nothing, and it was usually there when they needed it. Because I remember – actually, listening to how we did this, my wife and kids, if they listen to this podcast, they will now understand why from 2001 to 2005 on weekends, I would suddenly have to leave. Because we had, at this time, no cell phones, but we had pagers. So I'd get a page from you on a weekend that said, hey, server's down. And I'd curse under my breath, and I'd get in my view car, and I would drive down to the office and make sure it was reset. Usually it was one of the bounce machines was off, and it just had to be reset, and then everything came back up. And so we had a firewall to this whole facility, which turned out ultimately, we're not going to talk about the building of all of this, but ultimately at the end of the day, it was a 12 terabyte server farm when it was all said and done. Had three mirror servers that we called the bounces, and it had a firewall that I remember Chris Avery and I were in no way, shape, or form Cisco iOS experts. And we spent probably 2 days trying to figure out why communication won't go through this Cisco firewall until one day I was able to fix the iOS and it started working. I have no idea what I did to it, but it started working and we were good to go from there. But then after paying $7,000 a month for about a year, we were able to move to a small little old Time Warner cable facility that was – West of Charlotte, in this little town, and it was a little metal building. They gave us the whole facility plus business DSL at 10 megs per second for $1,500 a month. So I started saving the bureau money, which made them very happy because I then needed to keep building up more servers as this went along. So at the time, if you remember, we claimed our servers were in Canada. How did you convince the groups to believe that we were in Canada?
I think that we had a couple sources up there that were providing software, and one of the bouncers services that we used had a Canadian DNS. And back then people, you didn't have, it isn't like today where you just go look up an IP and do geolocation and stuff like that. That stuff didn't exist back then. So it was really easy, even with the internet, to manipulate and make people think that things weren't where they really were. And the other thing too is a lot of people didn't understand dynamic DNS. Domain assignment. So the fact that one of the DynDNS services was in Canada, when you did do a whois on it, it showed up as a Canadian resource. And so therefore, we're like, yeah, our stuff's in Canada. So that was, they checked on it, but it just worked out by more happenstance than anything. I just exploited the fact that it was there.
Yeah, and then we also when we went to Time Warner Cable, I was able to get them to screw with our trace route. So if you trace routed any of the servers, the last three hops would go to Atlanta, and then there'd be three dots. And I remember you used to always tell them, "Well, those three dots is how it gets to Canada. One of those dots is Canada." And that was the beautiful thing about all this at the time was it didn't matter what you said, they all believed it.
That's right.
And why was it? And because
nobody understood it. And
And why was trust? I mean, trusting to be an interesting thing because they would really go through a lot of machinations to make sure that you could get in the group. But once you were in, you could tell them anything and they would trust you, correct?
Pretty much. I mean, it was getting in, you were extremely scrutinized. And I think the other thing that was key that I looked for was who really made decisions in these groups, right? You had the person that was in charge of the group, right? But then you had the folks that were the underlings and, the commanders, if you will, whatever. But what I found was the leaders of the groups were probably the most laid back. They were the most comfortable in their skin because they were already established, whereas the other leaders felt like they still had something to prove. And by being the voice of opposition when it came to new recruits, they were tasked with, you know, well, I need you to go check this person out. Well, when you come in with an environment that, that like we had, we ended up becoming more word of mouth.
Yeah.
So our, introductions were straight to the leaders all the time, right? So I think that by having the leader's trust right out of the gate really bought us, you know, credibility more so than I think a lot of people that were established. Now, that wasn't always the case. There was a group out of France that, if you remember, that guy, I still think he figured it out, but nobody believed him, which is hilarious, even when he posted about it.
Yeah.
Talk about the reveal on that if you want, but in any case, it all came back to credibility, and it all came back to literally who you know.
And the funny thing for us is on December 11th is when we got the undercover approved, but also on December 11th, 2001, the border custom service, no, it wasn't custom and border patrol, just the custom service, did Operation Buccaneer at the same day and targeted 62 people. So at the time, that was the biggest takedown of the WERS community at the time. And I think that started making people nervous about being hosting stuff in the U.S., which made our Canadian aspect even that much more needed, or it really worked for us in that respect.
Right, right. Well, the other thing too that I remember about Buccaneer was that one of the groups that actually they went after, I was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to come up with a really good reason why I didn't get caught.
Oh, right, right.
Or
right.
I didn't get, you know, raided, right? So, and this, if you remember, this was a continuous theme where every time there was a bust, we had to come up with a really good reason. And I'm still looking for my Oscar on that.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
In
2000,
I really had
go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because in 2004.
No, I was going to say, because even.
You go. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead. You go, and I'll go after you. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah. So I was going to say, because every time this occurred, we had to come up with a reason, and the reason could not always be the same because these people didn't forget, right? So, and the other thing too was we had to take action. Everybody was shutting down their servers, so we had to shut down our servers, right? And we asked, "Oh, is the archive still up?" No, we're just taking it down as a precautionary measure.
Yep.
We did leave it up once, and we got questioned why it was still up. And so that was kind of a lesson learned. And I just said, "Oh, the admin's not available. He's got to drive out there and shut it off." Yeah. You know, so, I mean, it was, and you did. You actually had to drive.
Yeah. So our case became one of three cases for what became, which surpassed Buccaneer in 2004 called Operation Fastlink, which was our case and a case out of Chicago and a case out of San Francisco. We all targeted different groups, but we all took everybody down at the same time, which again caused, and the ironic thing, this very rarely happens in the FBI when you have an undercover and it goes down. Usually if you have sources in that undercover, that's it for them. They pretty much probably burn because they have to testify and do all this other stuff. Well, the guys we targeted, they all pled guilty. None of them went to trial. So there was never your identity never came to risk. And we were able to, once Fastlink happened, of the three cases, ours continued on, and we just reformatted what we called ourselves. You changed who you were talking to. You, like you said, you danced around a couple people's questions, and they continued on anyway with us.
That's right. And yeah, the archive lived.
It was, you know, I think, so, it was the size.
Time,
it was
this, I think by then the archive, yeah, at that time the archive was 4 terabytes with our story, which right. It wasn't even close to.
No, at that time, well, at that time it might have been 4 or 5, but at the end, within another year, because we did this for another year with like 4 or 5 new groups that we targeted that you were able to convince to come in and, hey, we got this archive. Come store your stuff here. We'll protect it. You can have it anytime you want. And it got up to 12 terabytes at the end. At the end of it, that's how big it was at the end. I think you're right,
right.
Though. Yeah.
Right.
Because they could never tell what the size was, but we knew what the size was. And actually, I will say towards the end, I got pretty good at. It didn't go down as much anymore. We had much better equipment as it went further.
Yeah.
Because the first one, so the first server was. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think we rebuilt the servers at least a dozen times. I really do think we rebuilt them at least a dozen times.
Well, we lost
before
one.
Before we got it right, because we had, we lost one, but you know, everything from heat, right? Heat was a big factor.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? And then the other was just the mere volume of information. It would just fill up to a point where it would just corrupt.
Yep.
Right. So corruption and heat, I think, were our two biggest, problems with
RAID 5 did not seem to be a favorable formatting system for us but for us, some reason we got around that eventually. And it's funny. So $1,500 a month for the facility we were at for Time Warner, they probably spent way more money in air conditioning for that than we paid for the rent, because they end up replacing two air conditioning systems, including a rooftop thing to keep the server room cold. Because I will say this, the server room in that facility was cold. You had to wear a sweater in there. It got so cold. But we had to protect the information.
Right. Yep. I remember going in there. It was freezing.
Yep. So after Site Down, was the second one, 2005. We kind of took it down. We took everything down after that. And then I think we started going after the Russian Business Network on a wholly different thing, wholly different undercover. We'll talk about another time. But how did what happened to Site Down in 2005 was us, Washington field office. I take that back. You know what? Chicago was in Site Down. New Haven was the other case in FastLink, but it's neither here nor there. You can look it up on Wikipedia if you want to see any of these, what these are. But so what has happened to the Ware scene since then? Because around this time when in 2005, 2006, we started worrying more about, or the FBI started changing priorities to more nation state actors and that kind of thing, because that obviously the damage there is even greater. What has happened to the Ware scene since our takedowns, and where does it stand today?
So it did, you know, by all accounts, it did take a big hit. You know, there was the bulletin board environments for direct communication that was non-IRC, like Checkpoint. There was ISOWare's sites where it would do the interfacing listing via the web. There was a secure site. So all of those, what would be considered today's Tor network, actually it was a very early version of the Tor network that is today, was shut down. All that went away. And IRC went from being used on undernet, FNet, all your public ones, to private IRC servers. So people were standing up their own IRC environment and communicating that way. Today, that's pretty much gone. And what I mean by that is that I think that the scene has realized that nobody's going to go after them, and they have gone back to a 2005 mentality. And what I mean by that is that after 2005, after that big bust there, they, you know, there was caution, there was paranoia that even still exists today. The only difference is that there is a public access mechanism for IRC and WARES today. There are DCC networks set up to be able to pull particular downloads. There are web-based download feeds that you can get with JDownload and some of the other tools that are out there. So all that stuff exists. What you don't see is if you want to communicate with any of the people that actually move and shake and distribute to this, they're not on those public forums. So that is the main difference between back then and today. Today, they're on private IRC networks. So you would communicate with those folks through a bot. Once they vet you, then you would be invited to that separate IRC server that is completely locked down, multiple levels of encryption, ident checks. If you come in unencrypted, you get kicked out. So, I mean, you really have to be who you say you are, and the ability to check people out today is even more so. Anything short of giving giving an actual phone number. But services like Telegram and others that are used for encrypted communication beyond IRC are also being used. So while IRC has been known to, you know, be captured logging, that sort of thing, well, folks are turning to other mechanisms of communication. So you're going to have multi-tiered communication levels. You have multi-tiered transmission capability, and everything is pretty much run by bots. I can tell you the one network that I am very familiar with currently is running 1,200 bots. It's got 1,200 bots, and they're dedicated to every bit software movies, not so much music, but mostly software movies, that is on the ready right now. But to be a source for that, either providing, software or providing some other service, it's not as easy to get involved with that as it was way back when.
Well, but at least we tried. So I will say, we could probably talk about this case for an hour or two, at least you and I could, but I don't think anyone wants to hear that. But that's a interesting little overview for the stuff that we went through. And I do appreciate you taking the time, and we definitely have to do this again to talk some other stuff that I know you're an expert in, but I won't say what that is, because that way no one can compare the two. So again, appreciate your time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. And let me thank the Bureau for keeping me safe and my identity safe. We did engage with some groups that had some very interesting ties to some very interesting people. And by keeping me out of the papers and keeping me out of the courtroom, it definitely contributed to my safety during the whole course of this, because you never know. I mean, you never know. Even then, you never knew who you were actually dealing with, right?
Yep.
And to your earlier point about my identity not being compromised, I think that it's safe to say that I was able to exit out of the scene still uncompromised, if I'm not mistaken. So.
Well, that's awesome, man. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
Yep. Yep.
So a couple final thoughts on this case. The final statistics, we did two large takedowns in 2004 and 2005 as part of Operations Fastlink and SiteDown. You can go look those up online. There's plenty of information on that. For my case specifically, Operation Sudden Urge, in Fastlink, we conducted 20 search warrants across the country and 3 in Canada. In 2005, for Operation SiteDown, we conducted another 20, including 7 overseas in countries like the UK, Israel, Belgium, Germany, to name a few. And so at the end, there were a good dozen or two folks that were convicted and went to jail. The first group of eight that were charged all pled guilty to conspiracy, and largely simply because the statute that we were looking at, 1832, theft of intellectual property, is very hard to prove in the sense of what you need a jury to convict on. So we were able to get the guys we targeted to plead to a lesser charge of conspiracy, because they were all part of groups that did these crimes. They got a year and a day, which allowed us to give them a felony on their record. At the end of the day, did we stop online piracy? No. However, I will say that we did disable it for about a year and a half, as John mentioned in our interview. So there was some success there. As I go forward with my podcast, we'll talk more about, get more in depth with some other type of cases. But in the early 2000s, online piracy was a big thing, and I was honored to have a part in it, play in investigating those particular crimes. As I mentioned, next week, I'm going to talk about protecting seniors. So if you have any questions or thoughts that you'd like to forward me, Darren at The Cyber Guy, cyber spelled C-Y-B-U-R, cyberguy.com. I will be sure to include those in that podcast. If you like to just send me an email with comments on things I can do better or things you'd like to hear in the future, do that as well. You can now get this podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, and Spotify, to name a few. So feel free to leave reviews there if you are so inclined. I thank you very much for listening. As you go out your day, understand the threats that impact you, assess the risk overall, and then proceed wisely as you travel online in the vast world of the internet and as we deal with the cyber threats that surround you. Thanks for listening.